If your libido's in the toilet, sex hurts like hell, and an orgasm is out of the question, I've got your back. Come Again, Sexuality and Orgasm is my solution-driven limited series podcast to get your libido to kick in and your clitoral nerve endings to wake up. You can find Come Again on drstriker.substack.com. When it comes to the risk of developing dementia, family history is a significant factor. Fortunately, it is far from the only factor, since we can't change our family history. It is well known that being sedentary, social isolation, smoking, alcohol, medical conditions like diabetes, heart disease, or even being hard of hearing can all impact the risk of developing dementia down the road. But today, I'm going to explore the relationship between the food you eat, cognitive function, and brain health with Dr. Annie Fenn, the author of The Brain Health Kitchen, Preventing Alzheimer's Through Food. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause, midlife, and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Dr. Annie Fenn and I have a lot in common. We're both OBGYNs. We both trained at the same hospital in Chicago, but not at the same time. We both regularly give classes at Rancho La Puerta in Tecate, Mexico, but not at the same time. We both like to cook and eat, and we both have a family history of Alzheimer's disease. But with all that, even though we're familiar with each other's work, we've never met. We've never spoken. So this is an interview I've personally been looking forward to. So welcome, Dr. Fenn.
Oh, hello. It's so nice to be here, Lauren. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, finally. I feel like, how is it? How is it that we've never been in the same room and talking before?
I don't know, but when I discovered your Substack, I hit the paid button like almost immediately. And I've been binge listening to your podcast. And I have to say that you are giving the best information about menopause. It just makes me so happy.
Oh, well, thank you for that. And I can throw that right back at you because I knew nothing about this stuff before and I have so enjoyed reading your Substack. Okay, so let's get started because there's so much I want to ask you. I'm going to focus on three different areas. First, we're going to talk about why food impacts the brain. Then we're going to talk about what foods should be avoided. And finally, and where I really want to spend most of the time is what foods are neuroprotective. But before we get to that, I want to know what made you pivot from delivering babies, doing hysterectomies, and saving the world from chronic vaginitis to food and brain health?
Well, it's not an orthodox path. I'll give you that. So I was practicing medicine where I live in Jackson, Wyoming. I had a medical practice for 20 years. Now, the second half of those 20 years, I stopped delivering babies. I closed the practice obstetrics, and I focused entirely on menopausal medicine. And I don't know, I know you were practicing back then as well. It was when the North American Menopause Society, as it was called back then, first offered an exam to become a menopause practitioner, a menopause expert. So I did that. I was one of the first people to take the exam.
It was a hard exam. I mean, people don't realize how difficult an exam it is.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. And I practiced menopause exclusively for those 10 years. And after that, I don't know. I mean, part of it was wanting to be home more. My two boys were in middle school. I was missing all their ski matches and soccer games. But part of it was just my brain wanted to do something more creative. And I always loved to cook. And I'd always created recipes and shared them with friends. And in my heart of hearts, what I really wanted to do was go to culinary school. So that's what I did. I sold out my practice to my partners. I traveled around and got culinary training in Italy and Mexico. And I came back and started a cooking school called the Brain Health Kitchen.
But there was also, I remember reading about one of the incentives you had is that your mom was starting to have some cognitive decline. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. So I was really intrigued around 2015 about the papers I have been reading in the scientific literature about the link between what we eat, you know, our dietary pattern, nutrition, and whether or not we develop age-related cognitive decline later or dementia. And I was even partnering with my local hospital doing cooking classes for people to prevent dementia. So around the time that I was immersed in this work, I would go home and see my mom and notice that she was declining rapidly from a cognitive perspective. She was diagnosed with early Alzheimer's shortly after that. She had a stage called mild cognitive impairment, which doesn't always go to Alzheimer's, but in her case it did. And you know, if there's anything that will make a doctor do a deep dive into the literature, it's when something happens to your family. And so I made it my business to learn everything there was about how I could possibly help her slow this process down. She already had early Alzheimer's. We just wanted to hold on to her for as long as possible. And a lot of this research is what went into Brain Health Kitchen.
One of the things I think is really important to emphasize is that everything you do is science-based. So much of what I complain about and rail about and go on and on about are people that just do what I call hocus pocus medicine, you know, where they just say things because it sounds good or because it sounds natural or because they think it's going to be appealing. And while I think a lot of the things that we're going to talk about are natural and are appealing, but there's also real data to back it up.
Well, that's what got me so excited about this in 2015 was that we had actual randomized controlled trials, which in nutrition is quite rare. We had, you know, solid observational studies, which are not as strong. But when you start to get a whole pile of observational studies that are telling you the same thing, then, you know, this is information that needs to be shared. And, you know, that we all have a problem, especially in the U.S., with an increasing rate of Alzheimer's and other types of dementia, which is basically secondary to our aging population. It's not just the US, it's all over the world, but our Alzheimer's rates are going up. We also know that at least 45% of these cases are entirely preventable. So that's a lot of brains to save.
Well, I think that that's really important because I, you know, mentioned from the get-go that people think, okay, well, I've got a family history, so there's nothing I can do, and nothing could be further than the truth, because what we're going to be talking about is prevention. And also right off the bat, I think we need to talk about the fact that women, just because they're women, are at much higher risk than the men are. All right. So my very first question is based on a recent Substack post that you wrote titled, "Does Alzheimer's Begin in the Gut?" So my first question is, does it? And can you talk a little bit about the relationship between the gut microbiome and Alzheimer's and estrogen and all of that?
Oh, yeah, I'd be happy to. So we don't really know what exactly causes Alzheimer's, right? Alzheimer's is not just one thing. It's a multifactorial disease. I think of it a lot like we as doctors grew up thinking about cardiovascular disease or preterm labor. You know, there's all these factors that go into it that are overlapping, some more than others. Family history can be a component. But with Alzheimer's disease, one of the exciting areas of research is that there was recently discovered that there's like a fingerprint of the gut microbiome that is typical for people living with Alzheimer's. And that means that there are certain colonies of gut microbiota that are overgrown in people with Alzheimer's. And then there are others that are deficient or not as many. And so this is called dysbiosis, gut dysbiosis, which is associated with many different types of disease patterns. But it's been shown that this is something that we should look at with Alzheimer's. And it makes a lot of sense. Getting back to, you know, nutrition and Alzheimer's, there has been described in many studies, many, many studies over the last 15 years, that there's a dietary pattern that can help prevent someone from developing cognitive decline that turns into Alzheimer's or dementia. Okay. And this dietary pattern is basically anti-inflammatory. One of the root causes we think of Alzheimer's is neuroinflammation that goes on over a long period of time. And so if anything that I've learned about the brain lately, I'm realizing that the gut microbiome is really kind of driving the ship when it comes to what happens with our brain health, because they synthesize neurotransmitters that have an impact.
All right, let me go back a little bit, because when we talk about the gut microbiome, which of course is the bacteria that make up the environment of, if you will, of the gut, what is going to influence that? I mean, what we eat is part of it, correct? But there are other things that can influence our gut microbiome. We don't all have the same gut microbiome. So what are those things?
Well, nutrition is a huge part of it. And what these microbiota eat, what they feast on, is fiber, fermentable fiber, the type of fiber that they can work on, the type of fiber that actually like travels through the gastrointestinal tract and gets to the lower intestine, that spends a lot of time in the gut. And so it has time for these microbes to act on them. So nutrition is a huge part of it, but that's not the only thing. It's also rest and sleep. It's also stress. It has to do with circadian rhythms, environmental toxins. You know, you could put some pharmaceuticals in that category, or also hormone, like endocrine disruptors. There's a lot of study looking at that now. Even our estrogen levels have a root in the gut. There's a colony of gut microbiota, and these are bacteria, called the estrobilome. And the estrobilome are specialized to basically recycle estrogens. You know, after our body uses estrogen, you know, whether it goes to the brain or it goes to the joints or it goes to the kidney or all the places in the body where there's estrogen receptors, it all ends up in the gut to be excreted. But there's actually a system, these estrobilome microbiota recycle it and package it up to go back out into the circulation, which is one thing we think helps mitigate the ups and downs of hormonal symptoms during perimenopause. Or maybe it sops up at times of estrogen excess in a woman, in a younger woman's life, like if she has PCO or endometriosis or things like that.
Do you think that this connection, this estrogen influence on the microbiome, is maybe one of the factors why women are more likely to develop cognitive decline and Alzheimer's down the road?
I think that one of the reasons women are at risk for Alzheimer's, and you know, we're saying like this is a significant increased risk. 2/3 of all Alzheimer's victims are female. Okay. Right. So that's a lot. It's multifactorial. It may be the estrogen milieu. It may be the estrobilome is in the background, you know, sort of pulling the levers of how much estrogen we get exposed to. We know that estrogen is neuroprotective in general, and the more estrogen a woman is exposed to in her life, either from her own hormones or hormones that she took in a birth control pill or hormone therapy, the lower her risk of dementia later. We know this. We also know that when a genetic variant is involved, like APOE4 is a very common risk gene for Alzheimer's, women seem to be more vulnerable to Alzheimer's if they have this gene than men do. And a lot of this research is centering around perimenopause and what happens in the brain at the onset of this transition phase.
And not to mention the impact of hot flashes of vasomotor symptoms, because we know that the inflammatory response that occurs with vasomotor symptoms may also have an influence on cognitive function, which is why the women who have the most severe and persistent hot flashes are the ones that seem to have the highest association with cognitive decline down the road. But there's also the sleep factor,
exactly,
too. You know, it's never that simple.
Exactly. You've written about that. I've written about that. Exactly. Some of the most, yep, some of the most important science to come out of the literature in the last few years is that, you know, we don't look at vasomotor symptoms anymore as just an annoying symptom that keeps someone up at night. It's actually a marker for small vessel disease in the brain. So it should be taken very seriously by anyone's physician or healthcare provider.
But I think the point is that estrogen has a significant impact on the gut microbiome, which in turn can also impact brain health. I think that's the connection that we're trying to make here. I did a podcast probably over a year ago, a study that came out looking at the relationship between bowel movements and constipation with estrogen levels. And that was really my introduction to the world of, wow, there is an impact on estrogen in the gut, and you can actually tie it to what's going on in other places that are estrogen related in the body. So it sounds crazy that I'm making this leap from, if you have low estrogen levels, you might be constipated, to it's going to impact your brain, but it's all part of the same idea. All right, so let me ask you this as we kind of move along with this. If you're saying that food and brain health are closely related to our gut microbiome and that estrogen impacts on our gut microbiome, but I think what I want to know is, does the impact of food on brain health go beyond what's going on in the gut? You know, is it all stemmed from there, or that's just one piece of the puzzle?
It's just one piece of the puzzle. It's an indirect effect through the gut. The primary effect is by having the metabolism of food that contains brain health nutrients that perform specific functions in the brain, like blocking oxidative stress or quelling inflammation. And many of these nutrients pass the blood-brain barrier directly to have an impact on the brain. So there are indirect things going on. There's direct things going on. One thing that is really important for listeners to understand is, you know, we're not really talking about diets here. We're not really talking about superfoods. Like I don't tell people that they have to eat a lot of flax seeds or a lot of goji berries or something like that, some like brain specific food. But it's really about dietary pattern. And all of the brain protective diets that have been proven by science are based on the Mediterranean dietary pattern, which can mean a lot of different things depending on who you are and where you live. But there's something about this Mediterranean style pattern where it's primarily plant-based. Remember, like the gut microbiota like to feast on all that fiber from the plants. And the food groups include like vegetables, leafy greens, beans and legumes, whole grains, nuts and seeds, fish and seafood. I mean, this is like the base of that Mediterranean diet pyramid, right?
All right. So before we get to what's good for the brain, let's talk about what's bad for our brains. And I think we kind of all know that processed foods and ultra processed foods are bad for everything in our health, but specifically for brain health, correct? So could you start by talking about the difference between processed food and ultra processed? Because I think that's a little confusing for some people. And then why is processed food so bad for our brain?
Yes, it's such a good point. So there's actually a spectrum of how processed a food is. It's not a black or white issue. When we think of ultra processed food, you might think of like a fast food hamburger and fries, you know, because it has so many ingredients in it. It's high in unhealthy fats, like saturated fats or possibly even trans fats. There might still be some of those in the food supply. It's high in sugar. It's high in salt. It doesn't have any nutrient value left because the ingredients have been processed so much. But there's also minimally processed foods. So a minimally processed food would be like a can of black beans. Okay. It was processed. Like they actually cooked the beans in the can with a pressure cooker. So it's been processed, but the ingredient list is very short. And, you know, it's a healthful food. It's great for, you don't want to cook your beans from scratch. You know, you get a can of beans. Things like marinara sauce in a jar. Some have a lot of added sugar and some unhealthy fats, but there are some good ones that are minimally processed. They're just tomatoes, olive oil, and maybe a little bit of salt, right? And some basil. So these minimally processed foods are really in our corner to help us put together, you know, easy, nutritious meals. But the ultra processed foods, the things that we get from fast food restaurants that are from a lot of frozen prepared meals, if you look at the ingredient list and it's super long, then you pretty much have your answer.
Yeah. So I think the key is obviously something that is, you know, fruits and vegetables and all that are easy. But if you're buying something that is in a can or a box, if you look at the ingredients, it doesn't take much more than that to know if something is just minimally processed or ultra processed. If you can pronounce everything and there aren't a million of them, it should be okay, right? Theoretically.
Yeah, and the more people get in the habit of, you know, ignoring any of the words on the front of the package, you know, because all these foods are, you know, designed to get our attention and tell you that they're healthy and good for us, even though they're not. It's just look at that nutrition label, that black and white nutrition label. And the more people get used to doing that, it becomes very easy to choose the foods that are minimally processed versus ultra processed. Now, the problem with these ultra processed foods in the brain is that they provide too much of the wrong kind of fat in the diet, too much sodium, which can be associated with high blood pressure, which is a risk factor for Alzheimer's and dementia, and too much sugar. When there's too much sugar in the bloodstream that goes unchecked, over time, the body can become insulin resistant. We all know that, especially during perimenopause, there's like this push towards insulin resistance. But the brain also becomes insulin resistant, especially the hippocampus, the memory center of the brain. So having insulin resistance is like one of those pathways to Alzheimer's. is one of the multi-factors, you know, that can lead to Alzheimer's down the line.
Which is why diabetics are on the list of risk factors for Alzheimer's.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Someone living with diabetes may have double the risk of Alzheimer's than someone who doesn't. But even people that have pre-diabetes or borderline glucose testing, they also have an increased risk, which makes it so important just to know that. And then you and your doctor, your healthcare team, can, you know, keep an eye on those numbers. And then you can look at your diet and your exercise in terms of your metabolic health. That helps with long-term brain health too.
So putting aside processed foods, let's talk about other foods that should be avoided if at all possible. So I'm just going to throw out some categories here and you tell me.
Okay.
Which will no longer be in my shopping bag. So let's start with sugar. Sugar's not processed, right? Good or bad for your brain?
In general, it's bad, but I have a caveat here. Okay. I mean, I create recipes that are like cookies and cakes and things like that, treats.
I know, they look so good. I see all the pictures on Substack.
And I have people who have cooked for my cookbook who are diabetics who wear continuous glucose monitors. And they tell me that their blood sugar is stable even after eating one of my chocolate chunk cookies. And the reason is whenever there's sugar in a recipe, there has to be fiber. So there has to be fiber in the other ingredients to slow down the absorption of the sugar. And I try not to use any refined sugars. I like to sweeten things with dates and things like honey and maple syrup because they retain some nutrient value. You know, sugar is sugar is sugar, right? It's the way it hits your bloodstream. But if you have small amounts of these natural forms of sugar, they're more flavorful and get away with using less. And always fiber. So instead of, say, all-purpose white flour in my chocolate chunk cookie, there's going to be almond flour, which is also high in protein, or maybe oat flour, which is a boon for like stabilizing blood sugar as well.
Yeah, I never thought about changing the flour out in terms of getting more fiber.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my cookies are satiating. You'll have to try them. I mean, one, maybe two, and you're good. But the other problem, you know, is that most of Americans consume their sugar in liquid form. And that is definitely on my brain harming list. That's on my do not drink list, okay? Is all these sugary drinks that are just, you know, so common.
All right, I want to go back to something you just said a second ago, because one of the problems with buying the package of Chips Ahoy or Oreos or anything like that is you can't eat just one or two. You end up just eating the whole thing. And then at the end of it, you go, oh my God, what did I just do? But you're telling me that not only are your cookies better for you and better for your brain, but you are going to get full more quickly with them than you are with a cookie that's made with white flour. Did I hear you correctly?
Absolutely. That's the hallmark of the way I create recipes. It's based on blood sugar balance and brain healthy ingredients and also taste. So in that chocolate chunk cookie, we can keep going back to this one. I'm happy to share the recipe with your listeners if you want. Instead of using butter in my cookie, which is very high in saturated fat, and sadly, this is on my do not use very much list for your brain health. Instead of using butter, I use a combination of tahini, which is a sesame seed paste, and extra virgin olive oil. And both tahini and olive oil are rich in monounsaturated fats. These are what I consider the brain-friendly fats. Okay, a brain-healthy diet is not a low-fat diet. It's very delicious, very satiating. Think about the Mediterranean diet. But it's very low in saturated fat. It's like less than 5% saturated fat, which means we're eating things like butter and cheese and red meat sparingly, but we're eating a lot of foods like nuts and seeds and olive oil and avocados and like whole grains give you monounsaturated fats. Extra virgin olive oil is like the perfect delivery of those fats.
What's so interesting about what you're saying, and we're going to get more into the good stuff, is that the things that you're naming are things that I always think of as using when I'm making, you know, dinner or an entree or something like that. But I don't think about it if I'm making a batch of cookies. And I think that's where a lot of people fall apart in terms of healthy eating is I deserve a treat. I'm going to have a cookie. Well, you can still have the treat without it being bad for you and bad for your brain. But we're going to come back to that in a minute because I still want to stick to my list of
Okay.
Foods that potentially should be avoided. So, all right. So sugar, we got that one down. And I am so hoping that you do not cross this one off the list. Coffee. Where are we on
coffee? But there's a caveat. I adore coffee. I just did a big deep dive into all of the literature on coffee and dementia. And there was a large study, the largest of its kind, come out of the UK Biobank just a few months ago about drinking coffee and whether or not it protects you from dementia. Okay, so coffee, the way most of the world drinks their coffee, okay, black and unsweetened, has been associated in observational studies with longevity, lower risk of heart disease, and lower risk of dementia. Okay. Now that gets really muddled when you go to the UK or the US where people are putting all sorts of things in their coffee. I mean, think about all the things we put in our coffee, right? All the different types of creamers and the syrups and the coffee drinks. Not that many people are drinking it black and unsweetened. Actually, only 17% of Americans drink it that way. But in this study, that's exactly what they found. The best coffee for your brain is without sweeteners, without creamers, and it's caffeinated.
Is it the caffeine or is there something else in coffee?
Well, there's hundreds of polyphenols in coffee that are also good for your brain. It hasn't really been teased out until this particular study how much the caffeine was adding. In the past, even like say a few months ago before I read this study, I would tell people decaf is just as good for your brain as caffeinated coffee. But now we've pretty much sorted that out because they looked at decaf versus caffeine in the Biobank study. So we know that caffeine is doing something special for the brain in terms of protecting from dementia.
Okay, so why does a little milk cancel that out then? Or does it cancel it out?
It's not known. They did find that in the study that adding things like milk and creamers, those coffee drinkers did not get this benefit of reduced dementia. Okay. It's not like it was bad for them in any way, but they did not get the dementia reduction risk. And I know people love their creamers. I know people are married to their oat milk, whatever things they like to put in their coffee. I was like that too. I was a big sugar and creamer girl for decades, right? And I weaned myself off of that when I started reading the research about, 15 years ago. And I've been drinking it black ever since. So it is possible. It is possible.
Well, sure, it's possible, but okay.
This is one of the theories, Lauren.
This is one of my vices, I do love my coffee, but I also do love my vanilla creamer. So do I have any options other than to drink it black?
You could go to a plant-based milk, like an almond milk or a cashew milk. I have a cashew creamer recipe in my book that I designed for my husband, who's like heavy into his, half and half in his coffee. And he likes that it's really good. So the theory is that these dairy proteins, these big molecules, bind up the polyphenols in coffee and therefore steal away some of the benefit.
Okay, because I thought it was just that you were adding something bad as opposed to it was actually countering the goodness of drinking coffee. So,
well, that can be possible because a lot of these creamers are ultra processed foods. Yeah. And it's kind of, what should you do every day that really matters. It's not what you eat when you're on vacation or, when you go out to dinner like once a month or something. It's really what you eat every day. And that coffee habit is something that could have an impact, over time.
I have my coffee and creamer every day. Moving on, meat. Anything, is meat okay, not okay?
Well, there's good news for carnivores. All of the studies up until very recently always put meat in the same category. Ultra-processed meats and unprocessed meats were treated the same in studies, right? So a lot of the older data on brain-protective diets said limit your red meat consumption, period, okay? Again, the UK Biobank is a study of 300,000 people. They have brain imaging data to see how people age and how their brains age. When they looked at the UK Biobank through the lens of meat consumption, they separated out the processed meats from the unprocessed ones. Now, the processed meats are like the hot dogs, the sausages, all the stuff that you see like on a charcuterie platter in the US. What else would be like lunch meat, things like that.
But not like sliced turkey. Like if someone has a sliced turkey sandwich, that's okay, right?
It's processed, but it's probably better than most.
Can you get sliced turkey?
But the ultra processed meat.
I mean, you get sliced turkey breast. So you go to the deli and you say, slice me off some turkey. Is that going to be processed?
It is. You'd have to look at the ingredient list. You'd have to ask them how they made it. Are there nitrites in it? You know, they inject the turkey meat with, you know, spices, but also chemicals to preserve it and to give it smoky flavor and all that kind of thing. So it really depends. There are good turkey products out there. I know people love their turkey meat too. I get lots of emails about lunch meat. But turkey's probably fine, but I would ask the deli, you know, can I see the ingredient list of the turkey? They probably buy it from, you know, a big company if they don't make it themselves.
Okay, so here's my question. We know that protein is good for the brain, right?
Yes, indirectly, yes.
Is meat protein good for the brain? I mean, that's one of the highest. I'm not a big meat eater. I eat meat maybe, you know, once every 3 or 4 weeks, but I do have meat once in a while. And obviously there's a lot of other ways to get protein in your diet. But I guess what I'm going for here is there any good to eating meat, assuming that it is not processed in terms of
Yes, absolutely. You know, that's one of the things that was so surprising about this study. They showed that you could increase your risk of dementia by eating bacon every day. Risk of dementia goes up by one serving of unprocessed meat a day, okay? But also the people that ate only unprocessed meat, their risk of dementia went down by 17%. So this is the first study to really tease that out and tell you that an unprocessed meat, like say a chicken breast or, you know, a piece of say grass-fed beef, if you limit the portion size, I like to limit these meat products under 3 ounces is what I would consider a portion size. It's actually quite small by American standards, but it provides lean protein. We know that older adults who hit their target protein needs, they age with healthier brains. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Maybe they are just active longer. Maybe they, they're less frail as they get older, so they're out doing things and more social. Maybe there's a direct link between muscle and the brain that has been hypothesized as well. But yes, meeting protein needs is important. Also iron, you know, iron deficiency is a risk factor for dementia.
All right, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about food that's good for the brain, you know, that protects those neurons. And I want to differentiate between preventing problems, you know, things that are neuroprotective that you want to think about before you have any issues versus treating cognitive impairment that's already present. So when we think in terms of the good foods as we get into this, do they do an equally good job of preventing problems as treating early cognitive changes, or we don't know yet?
This is such an important distinction. Everything I'm talking about is in the realm of prevention. It's like taking a healthy brain and keeping it from developing Alzheimer's or dementia decades later. Now, there are studies, like we could go back to my mom when she was diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment. There are studies that show that someone with MCI, if they adopt a brain-protected diet, such as a Mediterranean-style diet, then it may slow progression to overt Alzheimer's. It may give them months or years to slow down that process, which means they might be able to stay home longer. They may not end up being institutionalized sooner, or you may just have more time with them. So that's important. But everything I'm talking about has to do with prevention.
So it's not going to reverse the changes. However, it will prevent or slow down future cognitive issues. And I think also, you know, we have to be clear for people that are listening is that if someone is destined to get Alzheimer's, even if you eat perfectly, it's not necessarily going to prevent Alzheimer's. It's just the idea being that you will have less cognitive decline or slower cognitive decline, correct?
Yeah, we're not really smart enough yet to know to prevent someone from experiencing this disease if that is what they are going to have. What we're doing is we're kicking the can down the street, like we're putting it off longer and longer so that if you were to get Alzheimer's at the age of 105, maybe that's not so tragic as getting it when you're 65 or 75. So we're delaying the onset of cognitive decline, which also helps people be cognitively sharper in the current time.
Not to mention, even though we're focusing on the brain, everything that we're talking about is also good for heart health and insulin resistance and all that, which the downstream impact of heart disease and insulin resistance is cognitive decline. So it's multifactorial again. All right, so let's talk about the good stuff, the good foods. You have referenced a Mediterranean diet, which I think most people have a, you know, somewhat of an idea, but I'd like you to get to be really specific. If you went to the grocery store and you could only bring home 10 things that you were going to eat for the next week, what would those 10 things be?
Berries. And these can be fresh or frozen. They can be organic or not organic. I prefer organic berries because they're very porous and they soak up pesticides. But if all you have is conventional produce, it's still better to eat the berries than, you know, hold out for something organic.
Are some berries better than other berries?
Mostly the dark blue, black, red, and purple berries. So a lot of the supermarket berries are perfectly, perfectly fine for, you know, they're delicious. And they also have chemicals in them that are directly neuroprotective. These are some of the nutrients we are talking about that pass the blood-brain barrier and block oxidative stress in the brain. They're called anthocyanins. It's a type of polyphenol. Now, berries are full of these. To be a brain-healthy food group, you have to have a whole pile of research to back up that this food group actually does what we, you know, helps memory and decline. Berries have that. We know that women, from the Women's Health Study, we know that women who consume at least 2 servings of berries a week, they do better on memory tests at the age of 65 and older. And a serving is just a half a cup. Now, in my book, I recommend 1 serving a day because I don't know anyone who doesn't love berries. And I think these anthocyanins are particularly important to flood the brain with for your brain health.
All right. Number 2 in your shopping bag.
Leafy green vegetables. So in the Mediterranean diet pyramid, if you can picture it, there's all these vegetables at the bottom, right? Including leafy greens. There was a landmark study called the MIND diet study that came out. And what they did was they pulled leafy greens out as its own food group and said to consume a serving of this every day in addition to your vegetables. And the reason for that is we have lots of data, especially MRI brain data, showing that eating a big salad every day can help your brain age better. It basically shrinks slower over time if you consume these leafy green vegetables. So there's always leafy greens, and this could be like a mixed salad box of greens that are pre-washed. And sometimes I'll just take a handful of those and eat them just like that. It could be a head of lettuce. It could be herbs, like fresh herbs like cilantro and basil. I consider those leafy greens too.
All right, number 3.
Vegetables. But everyone knows that we're supposed to eat vegetables, right? It's good for our health.
Yeah. What are the top vegetables? If we're talking,
I like to make it more specific for people. So mushrooms. Okay. We all know these are fungi. They're not actually vegetable in the vegetable kingdom, but I made them an honorary vegetable in my book because there is data to show that eating 2 servings of mushrooms a week can help reduce the risk of dementia later. This comes from mushroom eating cultures in Singapore, Japan, and Northern Italy. So a serving of mushrooms is 1/2 cup cooked. Okay. So if
and
you like mushrooms, go
for it. All mushrooms are equal?
You know, the wild mushrooms definitely have more glutathione and ergothionine, these brain health nutrients, but you can also get them in like inexpensive button mushrooms at the grocery store. So no, eat whatever kind of mushrooms you like and you can afford is what I would say. Another vegetable I would look for are any of the colorful root vegetables, okay, because they contain carotenoids, another of these brain health nutrients that I want you to flood your brain with, okay? That would include beets and carrots and parsnips and celery root and things like that.
All right, I think we're up to number 5 in your grocery bag.
Yeah.
You haven't had any dairy yet.
I have one more vegetable kingdom.
Okay.
I don't know. Don't forget the cruciferous vegetables. They are particularly potent for your health because they contain sulforaphane, which is an antioxidant nutrient. So the cruciferous vegetables include kale, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cabbages, cauliflower, all those good things.
So if we put those 3 vegetables you want in there, that's 4, 5, and 6. So now we're up, we've got 4 more, 7, 8, 9, 10 for what you absolutely, this is it that you're only going to get for the week. It's got to cover it all. So what's another 4
okay.
things?
I would load up on walnuts.
That's the nut of choice, or you just like walnuts?
No, but only because I get one choice.
Okay.
You could also choose pistachios or almonds or cashews. I added seeds as an honorary food group in my book because seeds have the same fat profile and nutrient profile as nuts. A lot of people can't eat nuts. So eating nuts, a handful of nuts, 4 to 5 times a week, this comes straight from the cardiology literature. It reduces cardiovascular disease, specifically heart attack and stroke. That's how it became a brain health food group, because it has such an impact on cardiovascular disease. And what's good for the heart is good for the brain. And that's why walnuts are going to be in your cart. Walnuts are really high in the monounsaturated fats and the vitamin E that your brain loves.
All right, we've got three things left. I'm worried about bones here. We've got all these peri and postmenopause women. And yes, we've got the leafy greens. That's good. But what else that's going to really help with the bones?
Eggs.
No one can afford eggs anymore.
I know. Well, I lump the animal products into one food group, poultry, meat, and eggs, because we're not eating a lot of animal products in a brain healthy diet, but we are eating high quality and small portions of some. Poultry and red meat provides, you know, lean protein, like we talked about. Eggs provide choline and lutein, and also lean protein. And hopefully, when the prices come back down, it's a good inexpensive source of protein as well. Now, what you're saying is there's not a lot of dairy products in the brain healthy diet, but one of the food groups that I added that wasn't really represented in the studies is fermented food, and my fermented go-to is yogurt.
For you, I was getting worried there.
Because what are you going to have
every morning? It's my yogurt and blueberries with some nuts on it, and I thought, yeah. I'm really hoping you mention yogurt.
And as you can probably guess, I'm going unsweetened and unflavored. I'm getting the plain yogurt that, you know, I've trained my palate to really like that tangy, plain flavor without the sweetener. I get the sweetener from the berries, and I go for Greek because it's higher in protein. And if I were someone who had high LDL cholesterol, I would go for low fat yogurt. If my cholesterol is just fine, I would go for full fat.
Yeah, no, and I think the key really is in the berries, because I used to really not like plain yogurt. But then when I started loading it up with blueberries and strawberries, it's really good. It's really good. How about frozen yogurt?
I think you just really need to read the label.
All right,
yeah, we have one more thing. Ice creams are terrible for you.
Your grocery bag is pretty full now. I'm going to give you one more thing to put in there. Is it going to be alcohol? Just asking.
Sadly, no. Wine.
Mediterranean, Italian wine. Come on.
So I have this modification of the Mediterranean diet that I use for perimenopausal women, especially, called the Peri-Medi diet, where I take all the good things from the Mediterranean diet, but unfortunately I take out that red wine dose every single day. Not to say that you can't drink red wine sometimes, but we know it has an impact on sleep. The data is very clear when it comes to long-term brain health and dementia that no or low is the best policy for alcohol.
No, I know.
When I say low, I'm talking 4 drinks or under a week.
Because I was hoping to go on one of your retreats to Italy, which we're going to talk about in a minute, and, you know, have some amazing wine in moderation.
We drink plenty of wine on these retreats, don't get me wrong, but, you know, when we go back home, we go back down to our lower no routine.
You know what, though? I mean, honestly, I think that's such a big piece of this, is that what we're talking about is an overall plan, which doesn't mean that you don't get to deviate from it every once in a while. It's just, what are you putting into your body on a regular basis?
Yeah.
I want to switch a little bit to another thing that I'm curious about is we've been focusing on foods, obviously, that are neuroprotective in the brain. But what about nerves other places in the body? I mean, for example, and I don't know if there's any data on this, I have no idea. But if you look at diabetics that have neuropathy, is their diet, other than being in good control in terms of their sugar, but I'm just talking about specific foods, is that potentially going to have an impact on numbness and nerve health other places in the body? And I have a specific reason that I'm asking this, but let's start with this.
Yeah, way, way downstream, way before it happens, way before someone develops retinopathy or peripheral neuropathy from diabetes. The brain healthy diet is like an anti-diabetes diet, you know, at its root, because it's low in sugar, it's high in fiber. And it's also low in what we call advanced glycation end products, or AGEs. These are the glycotoxins that damage blood vessels and can lead to peripheral neuropathy in diabetics. AGEs come from processed food. So if you're following a brain healthy diet, you're eating a lot of whole foods, you're cooking it very gently. There's a whole set of brain healthy cooking techniques that I recommend that are designed to retain nutrients in the food, but also not rack up these AGEs, which are not only inflammatory blood vessels, but also inflammatory to neurons, and they pass the blood-brain barrier.
So the reason I was asking this question is one of my areas of interest is orgasmic dysfunction, and a lot of women that have difficulty having problems with orgasm, it's because of nerve degeneration in the clitoris, which have teeny tiny little nerves. And we know that in addition to aging, that there are a lot of other things that can desensitize these nerves, which is why diabetics have so much trouble. So I just thought I would make the point that if women eat a brain healthy, nerve healthy diet, they'll have better orgasms. Has anyone else ever asked you this question? And what is the
answer?
No
one's ever asked me that, but it makes perfect sense because I always think about the end organ effect of what we eat and how we live our lives, because that's basically what it gets down to in terms of disease and symptomatology and how we age. So I think that's an incredibly important point. I will tell you that Alzheimer's is the most studied in terms of the impact of nutrition on neurodegenerative diseases, because, you know, of all dementia is the umbrella term, 70% of that is Alzheimer's. Alzheimer's has a biomarker that makes it easy to study, right? We can study amyloid and tau proteins in the blood and the brain and things like that. But now we're starting to apply these brain protective diets to other neurodegenerative diseases and finding that it reduces the risk of Parkinson's disease and certainly vascular dementia. I'd like to see more data on ALS, on MS, on things like that. They're neurodegenerative in nature. We just don't have the data now.
Yeah. I'm wondering, obviously, there's a huge science behind this, and this is your life's work, and this is also incredibly fascinating and can really make a difference. Are neurologists on board with this? I've never heard a neurologist speak about this.
Not many of them are. Most neurologists are trained to treat disease, and most of them are working extremely hard to keep up with the volume of people that are presenting with cognitive decline. And at that point, of course, you know, I wouldn't recommend a brain protective diet unless it was very, very early. There's one preventive neurologist that I know. Her name is Dr. Kellyanne Niotis. She created her own fellowship in preventive neurology at Weill Cornell. She's out practicing and does research, and she's fantastic. And she needs to be cloned because most neurologists are not thinking about prevention. Yeah. They are trying to keep up with the volume of people that come to them for help.
And well, just think about this, though, is that the majority of patients that neurologists see who already have significant cognitive decline, who's bringing them to see the neurologist?
It's exactly
their daughters. It's their sons. It's a family member who are also at risk. So one would think that this would be a topic of discussion to say, you know, I'm sure you're wondering about what you can do. And this is something that really everyone
exactly
should know
and
about.
You know, all the data we have, the bulk of the data we have about how to protect your brain pertains to people at midlife between the ages of 45 and 65. We know that this time period, this midlife time period, especially for women, because women are getting more Alzheimer's, is really important to prevent Alzheimer's later. We're starting to get data on young adults, like what you do in your 20s and 30s, like how you exercise, how you eat, how that impacts long-term brain health. And we know that even if you're over 65, it's not too late to prevent. So it's never too early and it's never too late. But midlife is a really key time. That's why when I speak to assisted living centers about brain healthy diets, I'm not speaking to the residents. I'm speaking to their families who are there to come to hear the talk, to have lunch with their residents. I'm talking to the middle-aged people in the room.
And how much does it make you crazy every time you see a Prevagen commercial on TV? I'm actually writing a Substack article on that because, as you know, there's no science behind it. It's completely worthless. But it has to make you crazy. It has to make you crazy.
It makes me crazy. Yeah. All right. I only see the shows I watch, so I try not to have too much TV exposure.
Yeah. Now, the two commercials that immediately go to silent are the Prevagen and the Cars for Kids commercial, just saying. There's nothing that is, you know, makes
Although I am in favor of strategic supplementation, there are some supplements that can actually fill in the gaps of a brain healthy diet, like omega-3 fatty acids can be important. Magnesium can be important. And we have data to support this, especially in women. A lot of women are deficient in magnesium. Magnesium has been associated with brain shrinkage over time, which I know sounds really scary, but even like, you know, brain shrinkage that happens slowly can be a risk factor for dementia later. So there are some supplements I do recommend, but not, okay, but the not, supplements, not that
are
drug.
These people who are deficient in their diet, or you think even women who really are sticking to the, you know, the Dr. Fen diet, do they still need those supplements?
I think they're for everyone. I've come a 180 on this in my thinking about supplements from the time when I was a clinician to now, because I could not eat. I cannot do a better job trying to eat a brain protective diet. As you might imagine, I live and breathe it. Even though I eat gelato sometimes, I drink red wine sometimes, I have white bread. I'm not perfect. But even, you know, I've added up my nutrient intake and I can fall short. You know, for one reason, it's hard to get good quality fish and seafood, which would be the 11th thing in my cart if I were to have 10, more than
okay,
10 things.
11.
Yeah, but fish and seafood is really important as a brain health protective food. It's a very important food group. It's hard to get good quality fish, and not everyone is eating fish that provides enough omega-3s.
Okay, so very specifically, if someone is going to go out there and get supplements, magnesium and omega-3 fatty acids, what should they get? How much magnesium? If you want to give a brand name, I'm fine with that. Same with the omega-3s.
Well, this is an individualized thing. Like, I'm calling it strategic supplementation because it really depends on the person. There is a brain multivitamin called Relevate that I am a big, big fan of. And I was, I helped design this drug with the help of a lot of Alzheimer's experts around the country. And so it's got a lot of cred and a lot of intellectual capital behind it. It's omega-3 fatty acids, DHA and EPA in a 3-to-1 ratio and bound to the right thing, bound to a phosphatidylcholine instead of an ester. So it passes the blood-brain barrier better. It also includes a really good formula of vitamin D and some flavonoids. Flavonoids are these anthocyanins. It's a type of polyphenol. It's what we get from all these fruits and vegetables. It's one of the pigments that we get from all of those. It's good for our brain. So I highly recommend Relevate. I highly recommend magnesium L-threonate. That is one form of magnesium that is thought to be beneficial and passes the blood-brain barrier more than some that like tend to hang out in the gut. And my favorite brand of that is from Momentous, a very good company for magnesium L-threonate.
I will put these in the program notes if you'll send me the links to those. And
oh, sure.
I have to admit that I've always been someone who's not big on supplements. I generally say you can get what you need in food, but you have convinced me that particularly if someone is concerned about dementia, that there's very little downside to taking one of these supplements. So I think I might change my tune on that one.
And one issue is sometimes I just don't eat enough food to cover all the brain health food groups. Sometimes I'm just not eating enough. As we get older, we tend to eat less. And that's part of it as well.
Well, also the foods that you're talking about also fill you up better. So you can only eat so much and be comfortable. All right, I want to hear about your retreats because I hear you're going to Sardinia. I'm also doing a menopause retreat in Sardinia. I think I'm going to be there about 2 weeks earlier than you. I wish I could go on your retreat if I wasn't going.
I want to go on your retreat.
My retreat's going to be good. My retreat is going to be very interesting with three other menopause experts, and we are going to be in the northern part of Sardinia and do lots of hiking and biking and eating wonderful Mediterranean food and having great conversations about menopause along the way. Tell me about your retreat.
Well, I teach in multiple parts of Italy, Puglia, Sicily, and Sardinia. These brain health retreats are like 7-day immersive vacations where we're there as students of the Mediterranean lifestyle. The more I learn about the Mediterranean lifestyle and the more I spend time in Italy specifically, the more I realize it's not just the food, it's the connection between the people, it's the stress mitigation that they have built into their lives that really helps them live longer. When we go to Sardinia, I'm really excited we're going to go to the interior where the Blue Zone villages are. We're going to meet with Dr. Gianni Pez, who was the first person to put a blue dot on the map and describe a region that had the most centenarians of any place else in the world. So we're going to meet with Dr. Pez. We're going to meet with some centenarian families. And we'll be hiking and biking and doing all the good
things. I was actually in the blue zone last year when I went to Sardinia. And it's extraordinary. It's really an extraordinary trip. And you are exactly correct. The food that the Blue Zone folks eat is just one piece of it. It's their level of activity. It's the community. It's relationships. It's personal interactions. It's all part of it. So I will put information in the program notes about you and your retreats and your book and your Substack and all the incredible things that you are doing. And I'm so glad that we've had this chance to talk, and I've learned a lot. I have to be honest, there are very often when I do interviews that I enjoy, but I don't come away from them thinking I didn't really learn anything from them. And boy, this one, I'm ready to go shopping. I'm ready to go traveling. And I am so excited to have learned all of this new stuff. So thank you.
Well, that just makes my day, Lauren. It's been a huge pleasure to speak with you. And I read everything you write. And I'm just cheering you on and all the things that you're sharing with the menopausal community. And it's a real pleasure to be here. So thanks.
You know, I think the obvious solution to this is that we need to do a retreat together. So we'll chat. That'd be fun.
Yes. We'll talk about that. I plan to hit other blue zones. I already have a Costa Rica retreat, but I'm also planning one in Greece and then possibly Japan.
Sounds good. I'm in. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Let's do it.
Thanks for joining me. And if you're looking for more inside information, check out my Substack. Just go to drstriker.substack.com. And you can also follow me on Instagram @drstrike.